Hi. Excuse me. I've got all my technology in shape now. And you can hear me in the back? Barely? Yes? You want it? Does that mean fine or turn it? Thank you. Sign language is also ambiguous, just like the rest of language. A couple of you are starting to work on assignment 6, and that is it. I'm sorry, I didn't print it in a way that would show up well, but you have it in your syllabus, so you don't need it. I need it because I don't remember what Julie made up for you as an assignment. I love that. Next time I'm going to videotape your face. Okay, I can't read it there either, so it doesn't really matter. Anyway, this is an assignment that is due later in April. And it is an opportunity for you to tackle Bronfenbrenner in another way. If you did the 5th assignment, which was optional, this one is also optional. If you did the 5th assignment, you had an opportunity to try to distill Bronfenbrenner to describe what a perfect ecosystem would be doing, what the various components of it would be like, and how they would relate to each other using his principles. This lets you build on that and apply it to a very specific situation, which is raising children. So the question is, if you really applied Bronfenbrenner's principles, if you took that perfect ecosystem that you've defined or that other people have defined if you didn't do it, if you took that and applied it in your own life, being responsible for children, what would you do? How would you create that perfect ecosystem for your children? For children. They don't have to be yours. I'm not assuming that everybody is going to be a parent. So these are the children that you steal. Or the ones that you inherit. And it's an interesting way to have a family if you have known anybody who's inherited children, young children, suddenly, usually tragically. It's an interesting way to become parents. Some people do it when they're fairly young, and other people do it when they're fairly old, when family members die or friends die or are killed or incapacitated, and people suddenly find themselves responsible for other people's children. So you don't have to assume they're yours. You can assume that you inherited them or found them, or they found, on the doorstep. Now you get to raise them, and in order to make this a bit of a challenge, instead of letting you just describe everything that you would do, you get to distill that even further to write. And the reason for doing this is to make you really think it through. That's reason number one. Reason number two is we have to read them. And we want to keep them short and simple, especially as the end of April comes along and we're totally overwhelmed. So you have to distill them into 5 rules for parents raising children, or people raising children, to be consistent. Okay? No more than 5 pages. State your rules, be specific, and support your rules. Why do you have those particular rules based on your developmental analysis of what parents should be providing for children? Okay, clear enough? And as it says, Julian, I'll be happy to look at drafts up till April 15th, which is a week from Friday. So if you want to knock off a draft over the weekend and give it to us early in the week or midweek, we'll get back to you in time for you to revise. How can you go wrong on this one? How you can go wrong on this assignment is to tell us what your parents did that resulted in the wonderful you, and tell us that you would raise your children exactly as your parents did because you turned out so wonderfully. We don't doubt that. And we don't doubt that your parents did a wonderful job and that you will do it just like your parents did. But we'd like you to put Bronfenbrenner in there. In fact, we would like you to use Bronfenbrenner as your guide rather than your parents. So the primary way to go wrong is to start with what you think would be right and forget to put Bronfenbrenner in it. The second way to go wrong is to state your rules but not back them up using developmental concepts. Okay. So the rules need to be specific and they need to be backed up using Bronfenbrenner. If it happens to coincide with what your parents did, that's fine. But that shouldn't be your ultimate authority. Okay? It's a challenge. It's also fun. And we will copy your papers, and then we will come watch. 10, 15 years, we'll be on your doorstep seeing if you're applying the rules. Greg and Julie are going to apply for a grant. Okay. Questions about that? It's spring. Something comes out in my spirit. I'll try to control it. Okay. Spring, a young man's fancy turns to love. Middle-aged men start thinking about bad jokes. Anyway. Questions? About the assignment. Yep. Bronfenbrenner, in fact, doesn't have rules. He has some guidelines, some principles, some things that we know in the articles that you will be reading. And those are helpful hints, but they're not really rules, so you get to make up your own. They can be as terse or as elaborate as you want them to be. The key is that they really need to be based on creating a perfect ecosystem for children to grow up in. Another question that sometimes comes up is, can you focus on a particular age group? And I didn't address this there, so let me address it. I would prefer that you think more broadly, because in fact, while you might be able fairly easy to come up with rules for infants, for parents or people raising infants, your job gets harder, as Galinsky is convincing you, in the six stages of parenthood. So I would prefer that you address more broadly what you're going to require people to do. As a segue into what I'm about to talk about, I wanted to elaborate just a little bit on the notion of inheriting children. One of the things that most of you don't have to worry about anymore is who gets you if your parents are unable to raise you. And parents get the final word on that unless they don't specify. So one of the things that you should keep in mind, if you become parents at some point, or if you know people who are becoming parents, one of the things that is very difficult as a parent to think about, and also sometimes difficult to take care of, is specifying who will raise your children if you are unable to. But it is an important detail to take care of at the point you become a parent. Because if you don't, and tragedy happens, and tragedies do happen, and they do happen to people with very young children. If tragedy happens, somebody has to sort out who will raise your children. And that's not a comfortable thing to leave to your families, especially as you may have families that may disagree on who's supposed to raise children. And there may be some concern that you have about who might be asked to do that. The number of grandparents in this society who are raising their grandchildren because their grandchildren's parents are not able to raise them, that number is increasing fairly rapidly for a variety of social reasons. But often those grandparents end up raising children because they've won a court battle, or a judge has said, okay, you're better suited financially to do it, and the aunts and uncles are too far away, so we're going to give them to you. It's much more helpful to the family if you have specified that and agreed in advance with the people that you're going to honor, with the privilege of raising your children and the responsibility. It is a major responsibility. But it happens occasionally, and it's much easier if you've thought about it in advance to do that. It's helpful to specify so that you can, in the process, specify who's not going to do it. My daughter called me at one point a few years ago. Said, Dad, I want to talk to you about arrangements for, at that time, the one grandchild. We've talked to friends of theirs who are also wonderful people. And we have agreed to do that for each other. Absolutely wonderful arrangement for them, because the two couples are very, very close, very friendly. My daughter and the other guy have known each other since high school. And they're all friends. And there are five children total, all within a very close age range. And when anybody sees the kids together, they say, oh, they look like sisters. They all have very similar coloring and fun. So they've talked about it and decided and put into their wills that they'll be responsible for each other's children. And I said, you don't trust me. No, I said, that's a wonderful, wonderful resolution. And that other thought I kept down inside. I am, in fact, specified guardian in two other people's wills who have minor children at the moment. And I'm hoping the parents make it so the kids get through adolescence and then off the hook. But it is a privilege, and it is an honor to be given that responsibility, to be trusted in that way. So, do it. And then fill out your advance directive for your medical care so your family doesn't do what the Shivo Schindler family has spent the last 15 years doing. Okay. On that cheery note, let's talk about weddings. How many of you have ever thought about your wedding? Right. Of course, you started when you were four. You started playing bride. You know what your dress is going to look like. I think I went through this before, didn't I? Yeah. Okay, good. We can skip over that part. It's all planned. As my nephew said, he's been happily married for almost 5 years. Just tell me what to wear, when to show up, and what to say. Leave me out of it. So, you decide at some point that you want to do that. You decide what kind of things you're going to say to each other. You decide in that process what kind of marriage you want to have and what kind of commitment it means to you. Or you walk up to a justice of the peace, and any of you done it the justice of the peace way in Vermont? It's lots of fun. We got married at Klinger's over Cappuccino. A friend of ours is a justice of the peace, did it, and she brings the forms. You buy her a cappuccino. And then she says, okay, you sure you want to do this? Are you doing this of your own free will? No coercion? You're both free to marry? Yeah. Okay, sign here. That's it. That's all you have to do. That binds you forever legally and financially, and there you are. You don't have to say, you don't have to make any commitments, you don't have to do anything, no vows, you just sign the papers and you're done. That's what the state requires. They don't care what you say to each other, it's just the signature. There's no requirement even as a justice of the peace, say, I now pronounce you man and wife, or husband and woman, or whatever. There's no requirement. You sign the form. If you are married in some churches, there is a prescribed set of vows that come published in the book, and you have no choice about those. In other churches, you get some options, Form A, Form B, Form C. In some, you get to pick what you would like, and you get to modify it, you get to edit it a little bit. And in other churches, you're encouraged to write your own. Those are the constructivist ministers who believe that it has more meaning for you if you construct it yourself and do it in the process of talking with a minister about what marriage means there. And if you do it otherwise, outside of church, you can choose your own and write your own. And many people do. They choose their own readings. They choose their own vows. They talk seriously with each other about what it is that they are committing to and how they want people who hear to understand what they're saying. That's a choice, depending on the situation that you're in. What happens as people are deciding on the vows is they are, to some degree, reflecting the macro system that they exist in. So in some churches, the macro system says this is it. In others, you have some options. If couples write their own, they are telling each other and the audience, the public who are listening, what they believe. So think Bronfenbrenner, the macro system. Well, yeah, it's the consistencies across the other levels and the beliefs that underlie those. So the wedding vows give you the opportunity either to accept the macro system that you're a part of, in the case of the church, or to define your own to each other and to the people who are going to be witnesses to that commitment. So it's a macro system process that, in fact, the macro system legally doesn't require. Legally, the state just says, sign here. That's all it requires. There is no representative of the macro system in that process, necessarily. And then you're married. And after you wake up and realize that there you are, you get to put together the various aspects of marriage. I've listed three of them here because they're important parts of the marriage as it happens. The same thing goes for civil unions in Vermont. It's the same set of issues that are raised and that people have to wrestle with somewhat differently in the case of civil unions, because the social marriage is going to be different for a gay or lesbian couple. Often the social marriage includes, or the social civil union, that part of it, requires family and friends who may not be particularly gay or lesbian friendly to figure out whether or not they accept it. And sometimes people get married and their families don't approve. Sometimes people have civil unions and they don't approve. The reasons are typically more focused in civil unions than they are in marriages. In a relational marriage, you start putting together the roles as you're going to carry them out. And often what people discover, even people who've cohabited for a long time, they discover is that marriage is different. There is a different feeling and a different view of the world that comes along when you are married. And that happens for probably three different reasons that I can think of. One is that you did it, and you're exhausted, and you're broke. And so the world looks differently to you because you've gone through that. The second reason that the world seems to look different to people is that the social marriage is taking place around them. Other people, other dyads, people in other settings, their families, extended families, their friends, now see them differently. So the roles change when you marry. And the hypotheses from Bronfenbrenner about roles apply. You now have a new role. It is different being a cohabiting partner, even long term, than being a husband or wife to other people. Parents now breathe a sigh of relief. They no longer have to explain you to their friends. They no longer have to hide you from grandma, who doesn't approve of cohabitation. Now everything is legitimate, it's okay. And there is some relief from pressure, relief from disapproval that comes about, and that helps the couple see themselves differently as well. The third important reason why marriage is different than cohabitation is that you have made the commitment to each other. And it's fascinating to talk to cohabiting couples who've been together for a long period of time. We often don't say the important things to each other. And one of the important things that people often don't talk about, even when they're cohabiting, is they often actually never talk about what their commitments are, what their understandings are. Marriage is an opportunity to look each other in the eye and say, yes, this is my commitment. And doing that to each other, that particular action, when it's two-way and sincere, moves the audience to tears. You love weddings, right? People say those wonderful things to each other, and you cry. Everybody cries. I do too. I love it. And the couple cries, or they gasp, what am I doing? And they make those public commitments to each other, and they've signed on the dotted line. There's no longer any question about the commitment. There's no longer any question about financial support, about responsibility, about decision making. Well, there may still be some question. But the couple's attitude toward themselves and to each other has changed. So the view of the world changes, the couple's view changes, everybody else's view changes, and the process of going through this wonderful joint activity, planning and executing a wedding is a major motor activity. Hopefully it doesn't continue. You do it once and that's it. You shouldn't make a habit of it unless you want to make a business of it and plan it for other people. Okay. So the relational marriage then proceeds, and we'll talk again about that in a minute. The social marriage, I've hinted, is about what happens in other people's views how they changed their view of the couple hooked up in marriage, and how they changed their behavior toward you when you've gotten married, what happens in other settings. Having a wife, having a husband, is different from having somebody you live with. And other people have to take some time to get used to that, to make the accommodations, to adjust their relationships with the couple, and figure out how they're going to relate to the, if this couple's moved into a new home, if they're living together now for the first time, other people get to figure out what their mesosystem connections are to your setting. Another part of the social marriage is that extended family and friends now change their goals for you, often. Their goal for you was, for many years, as you cohabited or dated, was get married or break up so I can date you, you know, whatever the wish was. And your parents wanted you to make it real, make it permanent, make it legal, or break up. And now that you've made it legal, they should be satisfied. Except if you're in the prime childbearing years and they don't have grandchildren yet, they're not satisfied. Now they got you over that step, now there's another one. Okay, honeymoon's over, let's get pregnant. That's what some of you have been through then. They want to know when you're going to produce grandchildren, and it becomes everybody's business when you're going to have children and why you're not having children. And it becomes everybody's business, in some families particularly, to put pressure on you, to express their dissatisfaction, to make it very clear to everybody that the whole purpose of this was to produce grandchildren or nieces and nephews. And one of the things that the couple has to do is figure out how they're going to deal with those expectations. Are you going to get pregnant right away and just tell everybody that? We went to a wedding last summer, late summer, that was wonderful, great big, huge party, wonderful. Couple had lived together for quite a while, and they had a wonderful bridal shower they didn't permit me to come to in the summer, and then a wonderful wedding that they did invite me to. And now there's a baby shower happening this weekend, and she will have been married 10 and a half months when the baby's due. And so there's no pressure. Nobody started saying, well, you know, when are we going to have your next one? But obviously they're moving along very quickly, and grandparents, who are friends of ours, are very happy about this because they wanted grandchildren. And this was about their only shot on one side of the family. So they're now pushing and happy. But for other people, one of the issues is how long you're going to wait, whether you're ever going to have children. Those options all exist. And for some reason, the rest of us who have some kind of concern about people feel it is our business to find out. So one of the issues for couples is how much you explain yourself to the rest of the world, how much you tell them about your goals in life, how much you have to argue with them, how much conflict there is within the extended family and friends, how much conflict there is about your goals. Are you going to have 10 kids? Are you going to have one kid? Are you going to have no kids? Are you going to wait for 12 years and then have a child? Are you going to wait for 12 years and then adopt? What's going to happen? The third part of marriage is what makes it different from cohabitation. And that's because you signed on the dotted line, you have contracted with each other legally in the eyes of the rest of us, the state, the law. You have contracted with each other to share resources, support, responsibilities, debts, obligations, decision-making,
You are a contractual, economic, legal unit. That's what those two signatures mean. And what they provide is that you have the right to speak for each other. You have the right to each other's resources, unless you have a prenuptial agreement. What you own is owned jointly, unless you agree otherwise in writing. What you do legally and financially obligates your partner. What you have done in the past obligates your partner. One of the things you want to ask your partner before you sign on the dotted line is, how much credit card debt is he or she carrying? It's fascinating to read the accounts of couples who get married and then discover that the other person owes $50,000 on her credit card or his credit card, because now you're both responsible for it. If you decide to annul the marriage immediately, you can get out of that obligation as a prior debt that was hidden from you. But if you stay married, you're obligated for it. You also want to know whether the other person has any indictments. I'm thinking of cases that I've known or read of where people get nasty surprises. One couple here had an interesting experience when she wanted to go to Montreal about a year after they were married, and they'd never been to Canada, and they wanted to go to Montreal, and he kept stalling. And she was all ready to go. She just figured, you know, go to Montreal for the day. I can do some shopping. We can have dinner. This would be fun. She couldn't quite understand his reluctance. And so she just scheduled that they were going, so he managed to get sick so that he wouldn't have to go. And this went on for several months until finally she just said, look, you know, what is wrong with going to Montreal? And he admitted that he could not go into Canada because of his drug arrest that she didn't know about. He was forbidden. Canada wouldn't accept him. When he got to the border, they were going to say no. And he knew that. But he hadn't told her that he had a felony conviction. It also meant, wasn't important to her, but it was important to her family, because her father was an avid deer hunter. And so he wanted his son-in-law to join him in deer hunting, was looking forward to introducing him to deer camp. Felons are not permitted to possess or carry weapons. They can't hunt, ever. When his father-in-law found out about that, it was not pleasant. Okay, so you have the debts, you have the past, and as a spouse, you get the effects of those. What you may not get, although it depends on how wills are set up by other people, what you may not get is inheritance that comes to your spouse. That's one of the few things that people can specify is not part of the marital property. So if you're marrying somebody who's particularly wealthy, you can assume that unless you're the very, very favoritist person of his or her parents, that their will is probably going to leave you out. And if you want, if she does inherit or he does inherit a good deal of money, you hope that he or she still likes you. Because I don't have enough legal background, I don't know what happens to the megabucks. Don't know. But I think you both own it, even if only one of you buys tickets. You both own pensions. Being married, it takes 10 years. You can't just get married, but after 10 years, you are permitted to draw on your spouse's Social Security or your own account, whichever would give you more money. So you get to choose. That applies to former spouses as well. So one of the surprises in remarriages sometimes is that when the person who's been married twice or three times dies, his spouses discover that in fact there's not a lot of Social Security because it's being split with previous spouses. Anybody who's been married to your spouse for 10 years or more gets to draw on that account, and you don't get all of it. So you get less than you would had you been the only person who is married to that person. You have an obligation to support. So if your partner, if your spouse, loses a job, doesn't work, becomes disabled, you are responsible. If he or she has medical costs, you are responsible. If he or she runs up credit card debt, has accidents, on and on and on and on. Any financial obligation of either of you is joint. And the only way to get out of it is to divorce. You have to break that contract legally, and even that will result in dividing the debts to some degree, so you may not be able to get out of them entirely by divorcing the spouse who's running them up. You get to own property together, even if only one of you signs for it, signs a contract for it, buys the car. The spouse has a marital claim on it. Spouses are often told, contrary-wise, your name's not on the house. You can always make a claim on property that the other person has in his or her name. You can always make that claim based on being married, and it will usually be honored. So there's that side of it, too. You don't get just stuck with the debts. You also get to earn the assets. Inheritance is automatic for spouses unless you have a will that specifies otherwise. And if a spouse is cut out of a will, if you're not named in the will, you have to sign. You have to specify that you know that and you approve. Otherwise, you can contest the will. So your spouse, unlike your cohabiting partner who can leave you nothing, your spouse cannot leave you nothing. And if your spouse dies without a will, the state divides in specific ways, with the spouse getting a specific proportion and children of the deceased getting the other part. And the only people who are provided for if you die without a will are spouse and children, not cohabiting partner. Okay. Cohabiting partner, if your partner dies without children and without spouse, who gets his or her property? Parents get that. So the marriage contract makes inheritance automatic. It also makes inheritance automatic for children. It also means you can file jointly for your income tax and claim the deductions that come along with that, which may or may not reduce your income tax depending on how much income either of you have. Children born to a couple, children born to the woman in a couple, are automatically the children of the husband. So there's no parentage issue. You don't have to go to court and declare that you are the parent. It is presumed that if you are married, you are the father. And in some states, I'm not sure what Vermont's situation is now, but in some states, even DNA evidence to the contrary does not remove the parental obligation from the husband of the woman who has borne the child. So the legal husband is the legal father in some states, regardless of what the DNA says. In some states, laws have been changed to permit convincing evidence to allow a parent not to take that responsibility. What that means is that if you are married at the time that the woman has a child and then divorce, you are obligated to support the child till 18. And there have been a couple of court cases recently in which DNA evidence has been used by men to try to get out of it, out of child support, and state law has prevented that. State law simply says, if you're married to the woman when she has a child, you're the father. Question. Even if you weren't married 9 months before the child was born? Yes. It's marriage at the time of delivery in most states that makes the difference. So the wedding, the marriage, defines the parent-child relationships as well as the spousal relationship, and defines those in terms of what the state law specifies they shall be. And that represents the macro system. Medical decisions can be made by spouses, and spouses are preferred. That's what the Terry Schiavo case was about. Who gets to pull the plug? Who gets to decide whether you can have surgery? Who decides how you're going to be cared for? If you are unable to make those decisions because you've been knocked unconscious, only a spouse can make those decisions. If the spouse is not available, then adult children get to make that. If there are no adult children, then parents get to make that decision. But at that point, then you're dealing with the possibility of family conflict, and it needs to be determined. But married couples, or in Vermont, civil union couples, have that right and obligation for each other. So the gist of this is that signing on the dotted line is more than making a commitment to each other. It's agreeing to take on whatever the state specifies will be the conditions for being married. And there are dozens and dozens of laws that specify the obligations, rights, the responsibilities, and the limits of married couples to each other and to the state. Cohabiting looks simple compared to that. Okay. I want to turn to one of the world's experts on divorce, Judith Wallerstein, whose work on divorce is not all that great, but she's rich because of the research she's done for the last 40 years on divorcing couples. About 10 or 12 years ago, Wallerstein got really tired of looking at divorcing couples, and she decided she really wanted to study good marriages. So she did a research project in which she identified a fairly large number of couples who were nominated by their friends and colleagues as having good marriages. And then she contacted a large number of couples about their marriages, and if they agreed independently, husband and wife, that they had good marriages, then she recruited them into her study to find out what makes a good marriage. Why is it that some couples are really happy with each other and stay happy with each other for long periods of time? She presents the results of that in her book, The Good Marriage, and I've taken just one part of it, because she tried to define what it is that couples face when they get married. What are the tasks? What do you have to do? And she identified these, I think these are on the website. Yeah, I'm pretty sure they're on the website. 7 tasks that may be problematic for couples. She calls these tasks because they're things you have to do, and they can be challenges, and not all couples do them well. One of the interesting observations that she makes is that if you look at the reasons for divorce, or the complaints that divorcing couples have, or the complaints that couples bring to marriage counseling, which is her first field, if you look at what problems couples are having, they map pretty directly right on these tasks. So these are the things that couples are trying to get it together on, and some of them are doing it well, and some of them are doing it poorly. In good marriages, these all happen, not necessarily without some problem and some conflict, but the couples manage. What Wallerstein presents them as, these are things you better think about when you get married, because these are the things that you're going to have to be deliberate about, you're going to have to wrestle with. It would be helpful if you talk about them regularly. Consolidating separation, she means, from families. Getting out from under and away from your parents psychologically, financially, and physically, as some religious ceremonies specify in the vows, you are now required to leave your parents' side and join your spouse. And that's symbolically represented by walking down the aisle with a parent, traditionally the father for the bride, and being handed over. I love it. I love the symbolism of that. Now, she walks with her father, and he literally hands her to the husband. He gets a sigh of relief, because he's no longer financially or otherwise responsible for her, and some other man is going to take that responsibility. And that's the point where the usual wedding symbolism and ceremony and I begin to part, because I also want the groom to walk down the aisle, preferably with his mother. And I like it. Have you been to weddings where the father of the bride actually says something, makes a little speech about what he's doing and giving his treasured little girl to this guy? I was outside one wedding reception that I was a guest at, which was lots of fun, and I happened to be standing near the new groom and his new father-in-law. And the father-in-law hadn't made a speech during the ceremony, but he was making it in front of the reception, just before the reception. And the speech went something like this: "I think you're a good guy. My daughter thinks you're a good guy. I just want you to know that if you ever make her unhappy, you will suffer." That's the speech for the groom. I had one, actually, before I got married the first time, from Uncle Jim, my bride's uncle, because her father was deceased. So Uncle Jim took it upon himself to sit at the dining room table with me. I was here. He was here. Uncle Jim was a former boxer, truck driver, and he sat at the table with his sleeve up, and he was flexing his bicep like this. And he said, "You know, my dear Catherine's father is gone. She's always been my favorite niece. I hope you'll never make her unhappy." And when you know a man has spent some time in jail for assault and battery with a tire iron, in a labor union dispute, you take that very seriously. So we were married in Chicago and then moved very quickly to Minneapolis and then Pittsburgh and then Vermont. I wanted to be as far away from good old Uncle Jim as I possibly could. What I want the... You can make it up. What do you want the groom's mother to say to the bride as she gives him to her? You get to make it up. Think about that for your own wedding. What you want your father to say to your about-to-be husband, what you want the mother to say to her about-to-be daughter-in-law. Like, I hope you can help him learn to pick up his sauce. Or, good luck, he can't cook. Whatever. But what you're doing symbolically is making that separation from your family of origin to the one you are creating. A family of affiliation, potentially a family of co-creation, and whatever the symbolism that goes along with that is part of the task for Wallerstein. Thinking of weddings, I have to tell you about my favorite divorced child who had two sisters. There were three girls in the family. The parents had been divorced when they were fairly young. Both parents had remarried. The oldest daughter got married at a fairly traditional age, and because she had a good relationship with the biological father, he walked her down the aisle. A few years later, the youngest of the three got married, and she didn't really have a relationship with the biological father. She'd really been raised by the stepfather, so without question, the stepfather walked her down the aisle. My friend had good relationships with both her biological father and her stepfather, and by the time she got around to getting married, she was in her mid-30s. And she called, "I think we're going to elope." This was after the wedding was reserved, the white Rolls Royce was reserved. She was marrying a guy who made a lot of money in advertising. They were all set for this. Cake was ordered, all that. She called about 2 weeks before the wedding. "I think we're going to elope. I can't do this." "What's the problem?" "I don't know what to do." And so she went through that, the whole scene of her older sister had had the biological father, her younger sister had had the stepfather. She was about to break somebody's heart. She didn't know what to do. She was losing sleep. She knew somebody was going to be mad at her. She didn't know how to resolve this. Both fathers had assured her, "Honey, you do whatever you think is best. It's fine with me." So she walked through, we spent about half an hour, she walked through the whole set of options. Her brother could walk her down the aisle. Her uncle could walk her down the aisle. She was really thinking maybe she would walk down the aisle by herself. That maybe. And then she thought, maybe my mother. Is that okay? Can my mother walk? So we went through all of that, and then she kept coming back to, I'm going to elope. I can't do this. I'm going to get sick. I can't do this. I said, "You have to do what you think is best and trust that everybody's going to be okay. They've told you they're okay." But she really didn't have it. 4 days before the wedding, I called her to see how she was doing. She said, "I woke up in the middle of the night." She said, "That's how you called, isn't it? Because you knew that I had done it. I'd figured it out." I said, "No, I called because it was Saturday morning and I knew you were in there." So, she said, "I woke up 4 o'clock in the morning, clear as bell. Absolutely. I know what I'm doing. It's absolutely right." "Wait." She said, "I'm just waiting for both men, both fathers to call me back." You know what she did? One on each arm. The fascinating thing was, this was a set of couples who had had a very nasty divorce, and it had been 28 years since the divorce. And the wounds were still there, even though both had remarried and, you know, they'd been through the other stuff with each other, and that was okay. But watching her come down the aisle with those two men, ear to ear, absolute ear to ear, was a moment of healing for both families. It was the perfect thing to do to bring the divorced families back together. And as a middle child, of course, that's what middle children do. We're the mediators, we're the moderators, we're the healers. So she brought both of those men down the aisle. They were met by their spouses, the two mothers, and everybody cried. Just because she was walking down the aisle. Had nothing to do with the dress or the flowers or anything else. Just because she had brought these two families together. At the reception, all four parents got pleasantly potted, shall we say. They all danced with each other. Ex-spouses, other spouses, all the combinations happened. And for a good deal of the evening, people were standing around cheering the four parents. And it was, after a quarter of a century, a healing moment that she had put together. At 4 o'clock in the morning, she woke up knowing what she was going to do. She hadn't figured out yet how powerful it was going to be, but at the reception, we had a nice chat about that. And she just said, you know, just... it was the right thing to do, and I don't know where the answer came from, but it wasn't rational, it just appeared. Okay. So, weddings have the symbolism of separating from your parents and establishing new connections. And in that particular case, it was healing connections within her family. The groom's family wasn't having any problem, and they just joined this big group of people. Building the marital identity, balancing how much you're going to be together, how much you're going to be separate. For those of you who took HDFS 5, you remember a discussion of Murray Bowen and his discussion of the fact that we have two opposing forces residing within us. It's called separateness. We all want to be and are individual, autonomous people, and we all want to be social. And in a relationship, the problem, the task, is to be able to balance the desire to maintain your autonomy and your identity as a human being and be appropriately together, joined with, merged with, committed to, in joint activity dyad with your partner. And couples who have been through a wedding often can't stand each other anymore. The bigger the wedding, the more unhappy they're likely to be. So then we send them off by themselves for a week or two to be with each other 24/7. Doesn't make sense somehow, but and they should have the opportunity to be separate at least a little bit during the honeymoon. But then when they come back, the task is to figure out how you spend time together, how you spend time apart, how do you get comfortable with that. And as you remember from Bowen, if you've had that, and the short version if you haven't, is that the difficulty for us is that being together and separate falls along a continuum, and if you get too separate from each other, then you start to get anxious. But if you're beginning to feel merged with loss of feeling like you're losing your identity because you're too together, too much together, not being able to hang on to your own identity, then you get anxious. So both ends of this continuum have the possibility of making us anxious. What happens in relationships when we get anxious is that we get squirrely. And people deal with anxiety in particular ways, but within the relationship, people get squirrely and they do things that are inappropriate. So what's happening in the relationship is that you're trying to find a zone of comfort where you can be together and separate enough and not yet so separate that one of you gets to be anxious, not get too enmeshed with each other so that one or both of you begins to get anxious. And couples find some routine, a micro system, right, pattern of those relationships and activities that allow them to be together enough and separate enough. That's what Bowen describes as happening in all relationships, and Wallerstein identifies that as one of the major tasks for couples early in marriage, continues to be a task for most of us. A couple of the difficulties are that people have different comfort zones, and some people, because of genetics or the way they were raised or what makes them anxious, need to be pretty together with their partner, spend a lot of time. They need a lot of contact, they need a lot of communication, they need a lot of presence. CE, not TF. Presence. Togetherness. To be comfortable. And if that's not happening, they get anxious fairly quickly. And at the same time, the partner ideally would have the same comfort zone. Ideally. You're in the same comfort zone, you want just the same amount of togetherness and separateness, and you're both happy. But some of you have been in these relationships where one person needs to be much more separate and with too much togetherness begins to get anxious and begins to push away. So this couple is trying to find a microsystem pattern right there. It's hard. It's difficult for them to find a way to be together and separate, a pattern that's going to let both of them be comfortable, because they are routinely getting into one or the other person's anxiety zone. So they can't just relax and have the relationship and do things as they could if they shared the comfort zone. Their comfort zone is too narrow, and as they're going through their daily routines, they're getting outside of it, so the person who needs more separateness begins to get squirrely. That's a technical term. Feel upset, not comfortable. And when people get squirrely, they do things like, I need time alone. Or, geez, do you have to be in my face all the time? Or, you're too dependent. Or, I'm going hunting. And those are not really good ways to deal with your squirreliness when the other person needs to have you together. But those are ways that are going to create conflict. You know, calling the other person names, saying the person is too dependent, just bailing out, running away, or drinking yourself to sleep because you don't have to deal with her or him. Those sorts of things are not good for the relationship. The positive ways are to say, I'm feeling a little squirrely, and we've had 7 or 8 days. Don't you want to go visit your mother? Or, how about a night out with the girls here? And I'll go bowling, or I'll go for a long walk. And you can negotiate, and you can pull yourself back into your comfort zone with the other person by changing the microsystem pattern the key is to keep the affect positive in the relationship. That means that you have to identify the issue, and you have to make proposals and be willing to negotiate. Hey, I need some time alone. I think I'll take the kayak and come back in a couple of days. How can I make it up to you? What would you like? Okay. So I get my 2 days of kayaking solo, and in return, we go out to dinner and do nothing but talk about you, or me, or the kayaking, whatever you want. So you negotiate so both people get what they want. They don't have to have it at the same time. That's one of the ways of resolving the task. You have to figure out what is your microsystem, and then how do you deal with it when one of you needs less togetherness periodically. How do you deal with it when you need more togetherness? How do you invite or request togetherness? Do you do it by blaming? You never spend any time with me. I don't think you love me. You never want to spend time with me. Those are not good for the relationship. Honey, I'm feeling a little alone. Can we have a date? About next Thursday? I'll come in, meet you at work, and then you get a hotel room, whatever it is you do that puts you together. Couples' creativity in managing to get what they need and stay in their comfort zone is crucial. It's helpful if before you get married you have a sense of what the other person is like and whether that comfort zone is fairly broad for you. If it's big and shared, if you're in the same place most of the time, then this task is fairly easy to accomplish. If it's narrow and one or both of you get really anxious outside that, then you've got a very difficult task of fine-tuning your schedule and developing the ways to communicate about it so that you adjust that microsystem week to week to have enough of what you want. Okay, we could go into more detail on that, but you get the idea. Have you been in relationships where somebody isn't in the same comfort zone you are? Do you want to be together every day and you abuse your cell phone? Any of you ever been accused of abusing your cell phone? Yeah. Get out of my ear. And what he does, right, is turn off his cell phone, right, and tuck it and not check it, because having you in his ear every half hour all day long is too much. Most of you use your cell phones in relationships too much. Jointly accused, if you're both happy and can afford it, as long as you don't do it in class, it's fine with me. Relationships change across time, too. And in the early flush, that wonderful rush of hormones that accompanies the early part of a relationship when you're courting, you know, being on the cell phone every half hour just might be fine with both of you. Eventually, you have to go back to reality and cool it a little bit. Then you need to cut it down to every hour or so. And the honeymoons are a time to be together all the time, no distractions. And then eventually you work out something that may be much less together comfortably as the relationship becomes more and more secure and as the couple is busy. One of the difficulties is that couples get so busy that they forget to have the togetherness time, and then they may both become anxious about not being together enough and feel the conflict that arises from that. But it's helpful to recognize which way the relationship is going at any particular time and be able to talk about it and think about it and figure out where you'd like it to be. Parenthetical comment about cell phones. There is quantity of communication, and there is quality of communication. You know, your parents, as parents, you want quality time with kids, not just constant kids. Couples also need quality time, not necessarily quantity time. And I think Bowen wrote this and died before the cell phone was invented, so he didn't say this. I think in talking about togetherness, he wasn't talking about the quantity of being in each other's presence if you're not in contact with each other. People can be together and very much alone because there's no communication, there's no sharing, there's no emotion involved in it. So that's not the whole picture. Part of it is, what is the temperature? What is the emotional involvement? What is the investment? What is the attention? What is the engagement with each other? And is that high quality, or is that just, you know, you're both asleep on the couch at the same time? That might be quality time for some of us, but it may not be for others. My concern is that if you actually listen to your conversations on the cell phone with your loved ones, you may be encouraged to question whether it's quality time. And what I'm observing in some people that I watch on campus, I do watch you, what I'm observing is that some people do talk to each other every hour, so they know what the other person is having for lunch. They know whether the other person is doing his or her laundry. But that seems to be all of the communication. Challenge in relationship is to communicate about the important things. And that's what's going on inside. Your emotions, your feelings, your hopes, your dreams, your spirit, your soul. That's quality communication. Hours and hours of cell phone charges, checking up on how are the French fries at Al's today, doesn't cut it. So it's important as a couple to be aware of the nature of the communication and to be aware that it needs to be quality rather than just quantity. Oh, good. We don't have time to talk about sex. Good.